It's the Burt Cohen Show. The feeling there's a global power oligarchy. Of course, you do from time to time get a sense of powerlessness here in these currently United States where it's supposed to be a government of, by, and for the people. There is this global power oligarchy. How powerful are they? How effective are they? What are they? Who is involved in that? Many of us have heard of the Bilderberg Group, the Council on Foreign Relations, the infamous Trilateral Commission, and others. There is a transnational policy planning network, and it's been in business for a very long time. Today on the Burt Cohen Show, we'll discuss what it is, how powerful or not that it is, how both left and right mistrust these shadowy groups, and where the idea of government of, by, and for the people fits in or not. Our guest is Andrew Gavin Marshall, project manager of the People's Book Project, head of the Geopolitics Division of the Hampton Institute, research director for Occupy.com's Global Power Project, and host of a weekly podcast show at Boiling Frogs Post. I love that name. Well, Andrew, thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, as you write, right after what was then known as the Great War, now known as the First World War, Paris-based International Chamber of Commerce met and was comprised of roughly 7,000 member corporations. They came together from 130 different countries, and after the unimaginable tragedy of that First World War, whereby disparate nationalisms clashed uncontrolled, resulting in the deaths of tens of millions, wasn't there a rather obvious need for a supranational elite, which obviously they have so much at stake, wasn't there a need for them to step in and organize perhaps organize the world to try to avoid such short-sighted dynamics which caused such devastation to make sure, or at least to try to make sure it didn't happen again. Didn't it make a lot of sense for those entities and interests with a larger vision to step up to the plate? Was it appropriate at that time in 1919?
Well, certainly they would think so.
Right.
But of course, one need only look at the causes of World War I to understand that elites cooperating and competing with one another can have extremely deleterious consequences for the mass of humanity. Because, of course, it wasn't the people who make the decisions to go to war that go and fight them. It's the people at the bottom of the social structure who fight the rich wars for them. And in the United States, there was a massive pacifist movement, an anti-war movement, which refused to go, which opposed World War I and any participation in it. And they referred to it quite bluntly as the rich man's war. And we shouldn't go fight Europe's war for them. And there were all sorts of socialists and anarchists and other radical groups which were presenting a major opposition to this war. So, of course, Woodrow Wilson in 1917 formed the Committee on Public Information, which was the first major propaganda ministry, literally a propaganda ministry,
yes,
in the United States to mobilize the United States population for war in World War I, and used the talents of Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, as well as Walter Lippmann, and several others who were pivotal figures in the development of public relations theory, of propaganda theory. Edward Bernays literally wrote the book on propaganda called, by that name in 1928, and they mobilized the U.S. To enter the war, and it was a hugely successful campaign. And of course, Ben Wilson undertook his Red Scare, which was greater than anything seen under the McCarthy era, where they rounded up thousands of anarchists, socialists, black organizers, anybody that they could deem as foreigners, deported them, imprisoned them. It was a huge repressive campaign to get rid of labor unrest and anti-war sentiment and other radical elements, which had to be done away with. And this is directly the same logical thinking, that what is required is an enlightened few to make all the decisions for the baffled many. And of course, Lippmann, who was central to the Committee on Public Information, was one of the most influential theorists in forming an understanding of American democracy when he was writing in the 1920s about the need to engineer the consent of the masses, and that for a democratic society to function, one must keep the bewildered herd of ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, these are his words, away from making decisions, to keep them as the spectators of action while the actors continue to make all the real decisions, because of course he considers himself among the actors, as all these people inevitably do, that they are so enlightened that they must make all the decisions. And whether the decision is for war or for, like the International Chamber of Commerce, for the benefit of the quote-unquote free market, which is being managed by them and thus not a free market.
Right.
The results are always the same, is that a few people, namely them, get more power at the expense of everyone else, whose power is undermined, and instead it becomes, whether it's power of pocket change or political influence, it follows the trickle-up theory, where it slowly just moves from the ground up, and things are further centralized and further removed from true democratic accountability.
So then you're suggesting that it wasn't a reaction to the devastation and the horror of the First World War, because, as you mentioned, certainly it wasn't, you know, the average person in Germany or Belgium or France or the U.S. that caused the First World War. It was these moneyed interests who had something to gain. So it may have been the same interest, but maybe, let me ask this, Andrew, was it that it was sort of a disorganized patchwork before the First World War, and that was kind of messy, shall we say, and that perhaps part of the idea by the new International Chamber of Commerce was to have these same interests not competing with one another, but just be more organized and avoid the unfortunate messiness of things like wars, but still have it so that these powerful interests, the people who were members of the International Chamber of Commerce, the big businesses, were still running the show. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah. I mean, of course, in any crisis, whether it's political, military, economic, or environmental, you're going to have elite interests organize and seek to form a consensus and a common approach to addressing the situation.
Right.
And just as a matter of necessity in such circumstances, whatever decisions they propagate are going to inevitably benefit them and the further strengthening and protection of their power. So yes, there was an interest among elites following World War One, which was, as you mentioned, enormously destructive, to organize and to try and prevent the future conflicts like that from happening. But of course, as circumstances change, then the prerogative of certain groups change. Their power itself can change. And so I think what you saw coming out of World War One was a great competition, first of all, between empires.
Yes.
But at the time, you were seeing really the entrenchment within individual societies of a state capitalist order. You know, you had the United States in the early 20th century was the richest, fastest growing economy in the world. Germany was quickly rising and becoming a major competitor. And you had all these empires which were competing. And suddenly, you know, through each world war, you see less empires come out the other end of it. But the ones that sort of prospered and moved forward were generally more oriented to the state capitalist system. And so state capitalist interests, such as those in the International Chamber of Commerce, sought to organize and increasingly internationalize to meet their interests in both national and international arenas. Now, whether or not they were able to have significant influence in the early years or decades is another matter. But certainly the intent and the interest was there. And the perseverance of the organization, the fact that it exists up until the current today,
right,
suggests that there were, there was success in the organization's intent. Otherwise, it would no longer exist.
Yeah.
But indeed, you'll always have conflicting interests, even counter interests at play, because you have increasingly international elites competing for influence against domestic or national-based elites, and they have may have differing interests at various points in time and competing agendas, and all sorts of infighting and conflicts between elites. And again, that's not a bad thing, but it sort of slows down the organizing process.
Right.
But after World War One, there were concerted efforts to increase coordination between major imperial powers and between the dominant power structures within these societies, namely the business and financial community.
So then, if I hear you right, Andrew Gavin Marshall, that nationalism was sort of a bit of an inconvenience to these supranationalist interests. It's just about big corporations making money and holding on to their real power and just finding a better, more convenient way to hang on to that power and to continue to shape the world in their benefit. And a listener wanted to find out about, you know, that this is something, you know, the intelligentsia, the wealthy interest benevolently taking charge of the futures of the world, including less developed countries, had been there certainly before the tragic First World War. A listener brought up the 1870 Berlin conference at which the European powers carved up Africa. And, of course, in 1919, a whole bunch of new national boundaries were drawn at Versailles, drawn by these centralized, concentrated interests. Why? For the purpose of, well, making money and controlling the economies of these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, I wouldn't say that their interests ran counter to the interests of nation states or nationalism. Nation states, the only reason why businesses and corporations have any power is because of nation states.
Yeah.
This is the concept of the state capitalist society, is that it's not about one or the other. It's about both growing together. And corporations are, after all, state-created institutions. They're legally constructed entities,
yes,
by the state and heavily subsidized by the state and
yes,
protected by the state. So in a state capitalist system, there's no such thing as a free market. It's only a managed market.
Right.
It's just that who is it being managed by and for? And it's state subsidy and support and protective barriers for corporations who essentially write the laws and agreements and expand their markets and thus expand their profits and their share of the economy. But it could be a free market, say, for labor, so that while elites and corporate and financial power will amalgamate and cooperate across borders, labor thus has to compete in a race to the bottom.
Right.
So you mentioned the third world, and this is exactly correct. You know, at the Versailles Conference in 1919, you had the fall of the Ottoman Empire during World War
I,
and so now France and Britain decided to carve up the Middle East and create, draw these borders, create new countries, put in tyrant kings as proxies to run them.
Right.
And they had been doing this in sub-Saharan Africa for decades, and this continued. And the majority of the population of the world lives with these arbitrary border lines, and that, again, is how nation-states serve power interests. Because they organize power structures, and they're organized by power structures. And that's exactly who they serve.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue is really that corporate and financial power has grown so rapidly, specifically in the last few decades, that the effort to organize state power in accordance with that evolution is falling behind.
Mm.
You have corporate and financial power on a very much a transnational scale, while state power is struggling to regionalize, as we see in the European Union and other attempts at regionalization. There's a lag behind it, but that's also just a direct result of the methods of integration and amalgamation of power, which tends to lead by trade and economics and monetary and financial and eventually political realm. But it's a slow evolution. It's just that these power structures seek to evolve the state power to make it bigger and more powerful for their benefit, of course.
We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Andrew Gavin Marshall, project manager of the People's Book Project, head of the Geopolitics Division of the Hampton Institute, research director for Occupy.com's Global Power Project. And, you know, I was remembering a phrase by Gore Vidal, who said that there's always been socialism for the very rich and powerful and bare-knuckle free market capitalism for everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it is kind of organized that way and has been for quite some time. And a lot of people lately have suggested that, you know, there was the choice between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, and skeptics, cynics have said, well, it was just a choice between two chief executive officer candidates for the same corporate interests. And as time goes on, you know, it kind of looks that way. And speaking of history a little bit, FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, in 1936, gave a speech just as he was about to win the election big time at Madison Square Garden, in which she said, and I can't remember the exact words, that in my first term, the big corporations, it was called, I think, the big trusts at the time, met their match. Well, in this, my second administration, they're going to meet their master. Now, as it turns out, he didn't follow through. They fought back. FDR was especially concerned about the power of corporate interests over what is supposed to be, in this country anyway, government of, by, and for the people. Do his concerns from the 1930s still ring true today? Sounds like they do, even more so.
Yeah, in many ways. I mean, with FDR, his rhetoric was more profound than his
absolutely
actual intent. And his action.
Yes.
FDR was really put in place to manage a growing social, political, and economic crisis, which threatened the social order, which threatened the power structure itself.
Mm-hmm.
The New Deal measures and all the various, the Glass-Steagall Act and all these various programs put in place to manage the crisis and to help get out of it were really done as concessionary measures to the population. There was massive unrest, specifically among labor and workers, but also immigrant communities. It was really spreading throughout the whole of society. And something needed to be done. The demands of the people were much greater than anything Roosevelt even attempted to do. But when he came to power, he came to power with the support of several factions of power, because, of course, he came from a prominent family who were embedded within the national power structure. And many of the New Deal measures were helped to be written and formed by people from prominent foundations, like the Rockefeller Foundation or the Carnegie Corporation, which represented those very same large trusts that he would use rhetoric against the previous presidents before him. But they, of course, were interested in writing the legislation and these programs with an effort to provide just enough table scraps for the people so that they don't rise up, but not enough that they actually get what they want and have a new type of social system. And even these measures were considered so obscene by the corporate elite in the United States at the time, who were noticing the changes taking place in Italy and Germany, and who were looking enviously over at their financial and corporate compatriots in those countries. And of course, they were also patrons of Mussolini and Hitler, the major business class in the United States, that is. And they attempted in 1933-34 to organize for a coup, a military coup in the United States, to install a fascist dictatorship. And they approached Smedley Butler, who was a Marine, a general, the most highly decorated Marine in U.S. history, and who led a number of campaigns for, he even wrote a book called War is a Racket, a number of campaigns for corporations running the U.S. military for their benefit. One of his most notable ones was the occupation of Haiti, which was from 1915 to 1934. And FDR even, he was a top guy at the Navy early on in this campaign, and he took credit for writing the Constitution of Haiti, which for about 115 years or so had refused foreign powers to own land in Haiti, because, of course, the historical notion of that was that it was for slavery.
Right.
And FDR went in and changed that so that American companies could come in and own land in Haiti. And he took great credit for that. He said they should thank us, of course, referring to the Haitian elite. So FDR was no real sort of champion of the people. But, of course, popular mythology has to be put in place.
Well, I want to ask, too, about, you know, we've seen through the decades, you know, the struggle, and I use that term advisedly, between the Republicans and Democrats. And as you mentioned, FDR used some great words and tapped into that energy that, you know, as you talk about, it ended up giving, you know, the some people some scraps, some crumbs when real radicals like Huey Long were talking about actually coming to the table, and he died rather mysteriously and was kept out of power. And so this was a way, perhaps, to, you know, to siphon off, to let off steam from these particular interests while keeping the same interests in power. And one of the things that we in the United States have relied on for many years for a whole bunch of different philanthropic enterprises, that's probably the right word, that have done a fair amount of good are these foundations. And you write, quote, "The robber baron industrial fortunes of the late 19th century, those of Morgan, Rockefeller, Carnegie, Harriman, Vanderbilt, etc., sought to shape a new order in which they would maintain a dominant influence throughout society." Now, a lot of good has come from these institutions, it seems. You know, we always see their names mentioned on the big corporate public broadcasting system. Tell us about their aims and results, and in what ways are they, as you say, engaging in social engineering with the purpose of social control? Where do they fit into the supranational corporate hold on political powers, these foundations?
Sure. The foundations are really fascinating institutions because they're largely uniquely American institutions created at that time. And many other societies, including several European states and elites, haven't sought to organize their own society along the same way simply because they didn't necessarily understand the institutional function of foundations. And because in many European countries they had the state, which would undertake essentially the same programs. But foundations in the U.S., which were mostly founded within the first two decades of the 20th century, sought to really organize the financial power of these industrial and banking families. So you had the Carnegie Corporation founded in 1911, the Rockefeller Foundation founded in 1913, and they were specifically interested in mainly two aspects, forming a consensus among elites themselves and engineering consent to the system among the population. So they would do this in a number of areas. They were very interested in the educational system, in shaping the social sciences as they developed. And of course, these industrialists and robber barons were pivotal in creating the modern university system. So, for example, the University of Chicago was founded by John D. Rockefeller in 1899, I believe, or 1891. And Vanderbilt University, of course, is named after Vanderbilt, mm-hmm. and you have Brown and all sorts of other sort of elite, prestigious universities were founded by these industrialists to compete essentially with the old order, where universities were more about producing gentlemen, and there was a more, I guess you could call it, classical education with sort of limited spectrum of study. Mm-hmm. But the industrialists, who were facing massive labor unrest, massive immigrant unrest, radical socialists, Marxists, anarchists, they were facing all sorts of problems, a growing middle class, which was growing hateful towards the oligarchy, who were taking all the power and reaping enormous benefits at the expense of everyone else. There were clearly signs that revolution was not far off. Right. So what was needed was to re-engineer the social order. Mm-hmm. So the universities were established with an effort to use the social sciences to manage society, so-called scientifically. Yeah. So it was about using the scientific management of factories, which these industrialists prospered with so well, sort of the management of time and how the factory works to increase efficiency and effectiveness. Taylorism is what it was called, scientific management in the factory system. They wanted to apply that to society as a whole. So for that, you needed these social sciences, so political science, economics, sociology. If you go back to the old sociology publications and journals, and the first major school of sociology was, of course, at the University of Chicago. And you had their primary concern was that of social control, so that the object of sociologists was to effect social control. And when the foundations were founded, they took that same initiative unto themselves, except it was institutionalized in a foundation, which later won... foundation board member once described foundations as a large amount of money surrounded by people who all want some of it. And essentially, it's a way for them to direct their own finances into various engineering projects. And, of course, it's all, tax-free.
Sure.
There's all sorts of other sort of underhanded benefits to this. But ultimately, the major foundations really took it to funding the social sciences in universities, developing new programs, shaping especially the fields of economics and political science. They founded major think tanks, provided the funding for them, which had the effect of bringing elites together in certain forums to discuss issues, form consensus in the university systems and the social sciences. And it's not simply my perspective that the object of funding social sciences was for social control. This is literally in the words of a Rockefeller Foundation annual report from 1933, in which the president of the foundation at the time wrote that we should be funding the social sciences with the intent of social control, of effecting social control, and that this was the general objective of the foundation. And of course, if you look at other areas they funded and financed, they're particularly interested in funding social movements once they already start up. Organically, foundations like to go in and organize them into hierarchical institutions, NGOs, nonprofits, provide their funding, or provide the funding to the moderate or reformist organizations, and thus undermine the influence of the more radical organizations.
Mm-hmm.
They did this throughout the civil rights movement, to the anti-globalization movement.
The anti-globalization?
This has been a mainstay of their interest.
You say the anti-globalization movement, what was the involvement there?
Well, the Ford Foundation is the big funder for the World Social Forum. And these major foundations were all pivotal in really developing and providing a lot of initial funding, at least, and still, in many cases, for the NGO world and for various nonprofits, which do on their own a lot of good work.
Yes.
So you have things like Amnesty International, America's Watch, Human Rights Watch. These were all sort of, especially America's Watch and Human Rights Watch, were very much foundation-funded projects. But NGOs essentially get their financing from the state or state agencies and aid agencies or foundation. And for the foundation, their interest is in providing enough funding to create a type of dependency, again, to allow for the engineering of consent. You allow for dissent. You allow for sort of an opposition, but you try to influence it. You try to control it. You try to at least direct it. That doesn't mean that you're always successful, but that's their intent. They certainly don't want to fund their inevitable downfall.
Right.
That's not their interest in funding these organizations. But if you simply look at the civil rights movement, which we have more information regarding foundation funding, it was the really mainstream, reformist, legalistic, very moderate organizations like the NAACP, which received the most funding from the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Carnegie Corporation. The more radical groups like the SNCC, which, of course, had Stokely Carmichael attached to it, these received much less funding. And ultimately, the funding for the radical groups would just be cut, and then all the funding would go to the reformist groups. And then, of course, one becomes a more prominent voice and is encouraged to engage in the political process, to help with legislation, meet with the politicians, meet the business people, you know, the people who matter and make the decisions. While the groups that aim towards radical organization, that discuss new paradigms, that discuss new ways of social organization, they get sidelined and pushed to the pushed out of the picture, essentially. And really undermine. And then you're able to profess, you know, a pluralistic society, but it's a pluralistic society for the plutocracy. They get to fund whatever interests they have, whatever groups, and organize for whatever they want. But other people in society, as in the rest of society, don't have the advantage of having the financial wherewithal to simply say, today I'm going to fund a political action committee to serve my interests. I'm going to hire a lobby group tomorrow, and I'm going to organize a think tank the next day and hire a PR firm after that. There's simply no possibility there. So representative civil society groups are organized by or are funded by elite groups to represent our interests. And then they call that pluralism.
Well, it's...
You know, there's a fundamental problem there, but again, yeah. We don't really need to discuss that.
Well, it's so much easier to depend on the beneficence of people with power than to actually participate in the decision-making. That's really, you know, tedious to take time out to do that kind of stuff. But it's an interesting thing because, you know, a lot of the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, they do a fair amount of good. And as you
Absolutely.
Say, it's not like these guys are necessarily evil, you know, or just,
nope.
You know, they're not snidely whiplash, shall we say. But they do some good things. And, you know, most of us agree, for example, that education is absolutely essential for people in third world developing countries to gain more real freedom for themselves. That if they don't have education, they just don't have a lot of economic freedom. And we think of the, for example, recently, the brave young girls in a place like Afghanistan, where the Taliban, they don't want the girls to be educated because they want to keep their hold on power. They want to be the elite, I guess. So what about the foundations in situations like this? Don't they contribute a lot to this situation? But then again, as I ask the question, I'm thinking, well, they may have some interests in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan and these Muslim countries.
Yeah, I'll give you a good example. In the 1950s, the Ford Foundation, which was the largest foundation in the United States and the world at the time, worked with the Rockefeller Foundation to fund various educational programs, educational institutions, and specific individuals in Indonesia, a country which was undergoing major, sort of independence from the Dutch Empire and a brief respite with the Japanese occupation during World War II, and you had Sukarno come to power, who was a nationalist and sort of a, I guess you could call him, moderate socialist, trying to balance the power of the military against that of the massive Communist Party and heavy sort of communist presence in the country, which was largely among the peasantry. Sukarno did not win great favor with the major Western powers for being what's referred to as an independent nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
But the Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, were busy funding the development of economics departments and political science departments and sociology departments at the University of Jakarta. And alternatively, they were funding in various schools such as Berkeley, the development of Indonesian studies. They would train, quote-unquote, specialists and experts in the United States on Indonesian studies, have exchange programs with the economists they were training inside Indonesia at the foundation-funded schools, and they would bring them to Berkeley to study economics, and this group became what's known as the Berkeley Mafia. And people often know the story about the Chicago Boys in Chile in 1973, trained in neoliberal economic thoughts by Milton Friedman, and when the CIA coup overthrew the democratically elected President Allende and installed Pinochet, the Chicago Boy economists were there with a new plan for the economic restructuring of the country, which has laid waste to planet Earth since then. But this actually predates the Chicago Boys with the Berkeley Mafia, because in 1965 to 66, the CIA supported a military coup inside Indonesia, getting rid of Sukarno and bringing to power General Suharto, who killed between 500 and 1,000 and 1 million people during that two-year span. A massive bloodbath, with the U.S. supplying a list of communists to go kill from the U.S. Embassy. And these economists, the Berkeley Mafia, were there right in time to hand in their plan for the economic restructuring of Indonesian society. And in 1967, a conference was hosted by Time Life Corporation, presided over by the chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, who was at the time David Rockefeller, as part of the Rockefeller family. This was held in Geneva, Switzerland. It brought together tons of mining, oil, energy, forestry, media, telecommunications companies from Western Europe, North America, as well as Japan, with the Indonesian elite. And there they sat in this conference in 1967 and carved up the country and agreed to sign several contracts. And this was what Suharto declared as his new order for Indonesia. And that order has been continuing ever since this time. And so that was really the role of the foundation-funded economists, was to engineer this transition in society. And, of course, these foundations funded university programs and similar programs in the Congo, in Central Africa, in Latin America, other places in Asia and in Europe itself. The Rockefeller Foundation and Carnegie Corporation helped develop the London School of Economics as a center for economic research. They also developed educational programs for Black Americans in the early 20th century, which were specifically designed to lower the expectations of Black people to maintain them in positions of labor and service industry. It was to train them for vocational services, not to give them access to other forms of education, which the directors in the internal documents noted that it would have the effect of raising their expectations, which can't be met, which is another way of saying we don't want to meet their expectations, so let's keep them low. And this system was so exceptional and successful in the United States that a little country at the southern tip of Africa called South Africa took notice, and these foundations helped them develop a very similar system, in the words of one of its managers, to keep the Blacks as junior partners in the firm. And that helped develop the apartheid system. The British were so impressed with the American Foundation system for Black people in the United States that they wanted it. They started to establish it in their colonies in Africa by bringing over officials from these various foundations to help implement this system. And then after World War II, you simply take out the colonial language, which had been discredited, and then you have essentially similar programs going on, although in the Third World it largely became about educating local sort of what's called indigenous elites. So you give them the training in economics and political science like they did in the United States at the robber baron universities in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and you essentially transplant that organizing system into so-called Third World regions to help develop domestic elites with a sort of standardized ideology. And yes, you're right, education is good, but education institutionalized has fundamental problems. And especially in fields like economics and political science, where 90% of what you go over is about indoctrination, not education. Sociology is better today, but originally it was simply about how do we maintain social control. And that sort of hasn't really left all aspects of it. But you do get a lot of really excellent critiques and study and scholarly research, but the mainstream elements which continue to exist in political science and economics today, these are simply about protecting power,
right,
and advancing power's interests. And the educational system does a great job of indoctrinating people to know just enough of how to get ahead in the system, how to help manage the system, how to be efficient cogs in the wheel, but not to know enough to really see the system for what it is, to question it, or to come up with alternatives. And that's what we call education.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that we should be exporting this clearly flawed, and I would argue failed system, to the rest of the world because their societies aren't doing as well as ours. Well, their societies aren't doing as well as ours precisely because our empires have destroyed their societies. Continue to advance our paradigms, our institutions, and our ideologies and push it onto them is a continuation of our failed moral obligations to the rest of the world, to which, I might add, we owe a great deal in terms of moral obligations.
I would say we do. We, you know, the world's resources are ours for the taking, I guess. And when I say ours, of course, I mean, you know, not just the United States, but these are beyond national groups. These are elite, aristocratic, oligarchic interests that have a stake in keeping order and keeping a lid on, for sure, getting people educated, but not perhaps too educated. And if you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is Andrew Gavin Marshall, research director for Occupy.com's Global Power Project. And he's obviously done a fair amount of research and host of a weekly podcast show at BoilingFrogsPost.com, I believe it is. And, you know, the situation with the European economy right now must be a bit of a challenge for these interests. You know, the British, there have been all these empires through the years, but, you know, the European Union exists now, and it's been a little bit shaky lately. How are these interests of which we speak handling the current European economic crisis? Are they just beside themselves, not knowing what to do? Or it does seem that there have been specific suggestions made and people put in power to help protect the financial houses and those powers that have been.
Yeah, I mean, in Europe, the main problem is that they created the crisis and are making it worse. With every decision and action they undertake, they're making it worse. For them, there are crises for the elite interests in the EU, namely that they want political power to follow the integration process and to speed up the integration process. So the EU is united monetarily, but it's not, and in terms of trade, economically more generally, but it's not united in terms of its fiscal structure, which is another way of saying it's tax-based and management of the economy is not united and not integrated, and its political structure. So if you read the business press and if you read, you know, the mainstream sort of what we call intellectual media, so New York Times, Financial Times, Economist, Wall Street Journal,
right.
You'll hear that the main problem with the EU crisis is that it was sort of a lack of integration, that they integrated certain sectors but failed to follow up with fiscal and political integration along with economic and monetary. And you'll hear that this is really, or that the crisis in Greece and Spain and Italy and Ireland and Portugal is a result of their domestic failures. You know, the Greeks don't pay taxes, they're lazy and don't work,
right.
The Spanish drink, the Italians are all drunk too, and the Irish, I don't know, got another sort of potato famine type thing. And, you'll just come up with whatever excuse you can, just so that you blame the people in each country instead of noticing the common denominator, which is the EU system itself. And in reality, it was Germany that created the crisis, because when the integration took place and when the euro was launched, Germany suppressed its labor force, kept wages low, kept benefits low, so that they could compete, which is another way of saying undermine the so-called periphery countries. So when Spain and Greece and all these other countries join the EU, they got a massive influx of financing because all the big German, French, and British banks decided to start throwing money at these new economies or these integrating economies, created asset bubbles such as huge housing bubbles in Spain and Ireland, and fuel consumption bubbles and debt-based consumption in places like Greece, and all this money came pouring in, but the labor forces in these periphery countries were able to maintain and protect their benefits.
Mm-hmm.
But because Germans undermined their own labor force, they became incredibly competitive. And when the German labor force said, you know, we want better benefits, we want higher wages, German industry simply said, oh, well, you know what we have over here is a lot of poor East German countries.
Uh-huh.
We're going to go move our factories there and exploit their cheap labor.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can simply agree to getting paid less. And so they did both. And they exploited Eastern European labor and undermined their own domestic labor force, which made their products cheaper, more attractive. They started exporting en masse to countries like Greece and elsewhere. So it wasn't only money flowing from Germany, but there were literally the exports. And this created deficits, which is debt, so that as countries like Greece and Spain were importing more from Germany than they were exporting, they built up these large debts to Germany. And because all the money was coming also from big banks, because that's how Europe largely funds its system, from the major banking system inside of it, they built up also these other massive debts. And then when the financial crisis hit, 2007, 2009, you had the housing bubbles in Spain and Ireland collapse, and then they were bailed out, which built up huge debt.
Mm-hmm.
And then European societies had to largely bail out their banks, which built up huge debts. And then suddenly in 2010, there was this change where the elites had decided at various forums, such as the European Roundtable of Industrialists, which is a group of about 46 of Europe's top industrial CEOs, which organized in 1983 specifically to promote further European integration. And they've been the premier organization in pushing the EU project in the last 3 decades. And then you had other groups organized around the G20, the Group of 20 Nations, which and the IMF and the OECD and various other think tanks all decided that now we are in the age of austerity.
All right.
And suddenly, we need to get these huge debts under control because these countries were spending so much on social benefits and welfare state policy, which had nothing to do with the massive debts that they accumulated, which were trade-based, which were based upon undermining labor,
mm-hmm.
and which were based upon bailing out banks from the asset bubbles that they created. Suddenly it was the social policies that got all the blame. So if you read the financial press but not closely, you'll just assume that it was the welfare state system
right,
that failed.
Right.
But the reality is that that simply had to get blamed. So you have Mario Draghi, who is president of the European Central Bank. In February of 2012, he gave an interview with the Wall Street Journal in which he said the European social model, the social contract, is obsolete. It's gone. So in other words, we're destroying the welfare system. And if you look at the bailout agreement, coupled between austerity and structural adjustment policies, and these have specific translations into English, I might add. Austerity, when you translate the policy and, or in other words, let me explain. To translate these words like austerity or structural reform, you look at the policies, and then you look at the results, and then you examine if the results it matches the rhetoric of what it's supposed to do. So, for example, austerity is supposed to reduce the debts and increase the country's sort of attractiveness to investors.
Sure.
So how do you do this? Well, you implement these specific policies, which mean cut all social spending. So if you have things like healthcare, education, welfare, pensions, social services in general, now you don't. If you have large sort of public sector, public employees, now you don't.
Right.
And then so the effect is that you create mass poverty and mass unemployment.
Right.
And you cut all the social services right when they are most needed. So you get sort of a general condition of absolute misery, and it goes into a deep depression. But it doesn't reduce the debt, because the result is that the country has to continue to borrow to pay off its interest on old debt, which forces it to implement more measures so that the debt actually gets larger. And this is acknowledged even by the IMF in a recent study.
Yeah.
So then you can assume if the same program is put forth and done time and time again, and yet the rhetoric doesn't necessarily match the policy, then you can assume that there's simply a translation problem here. Because, as Einstein said, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, is the definition of insanity.
Absolutely.
I don't necessarily think these institutions or individuals are insane.
No.
They might be sociopathic, but not necessarily insane. And so, to translate austerity, you translate it into impoverishment. Because that's simply what the effect of these policies has. And if they're continued time and time again, as they have been for over 30 years, you can assume that that's the intended effect.
Well, as you said, I got to wrap it up here, but, you know, what these elites believe, they are the smartest kids in the room and that they know all the answers to everything. And there's a reason why right and left oftentimes agree that we're concerned about the Council on Foreign Relations, all this concentrated, centralized power, you know, that the left and right recognizes that this is something that we have to deal with. If people are interested in reading more about what you're up to, Andrew Gavin Marshall, there's a website to which you can point them.
Yes, absolutely. You can check out andrewgavinmarshall.com and thepeoplesbookproject.com. And check out the Global Power Project on Occupy.com. Also check out the HamptonInstitution.org.
Thank you so much. It's been very, very informative. Thank you so much, Andrew Gavin Marshall, for being with us on The Burt Cohen Show today.
Thanks for having me.
And as Leslie Gore said, we don't want anybody to own us.